Welcome back to Girl on the Gov, the podcast,
where we're shooting the shit with elected officials and candidates running for office to get to know the person beyond the politics.
Because politicians needed a rebrand.
All right, guys, we're back. We're back with another episode.
We're literally back to our old ways with this episode.
For like a hot second. Okay, so basically, let me give you the backstory. So some of you will know some of the backstory of we changed our format earlier this spring to be exclusive to candidates and elected officials. And generally speaking, like 99.9% of the time, like that is still true. Okay, kabish. Especially for all the PR girlies that are listening.
Don't worry.
Take note. Thank you. However,
this one is an exception.
Because we have two amazing guests that are talking to us about a topic that we have yet to cover. We did a little bit back in, I think it was March, a little TikTok series with one of these gals, which we'll introduce in a second. And it's about nuclear weapons. Nukes. Yep. The girlies in STEM, please rise.
Which, like,
we have arrived.
It's so fascinating, and you'll all see in this interview, but, like, also talking about nukes and, like, voting is, like, interesting because it's two things, like, you don't always put together, and it's not really a topic that you also, like, vote about, but you absolutely should because, hello? We get into all of that today with these guests, so it's, like, a special informative episode that also obviously ties back to the election and more of the stakes of this election.
Totally. And I think to like really just grill it down because they're nonpartisan, but obviously we are. Sorry. It is what it is. You guys remember we tried for about a week back in the day, back in 2020. It didn't work out for us. We nailed in that coffin. But regardless, just think, imagine in your head, who has the nuclear codes? Okay. Kamala. Trump with his ketchup, RFK Jr. with his skinned dead bear that he put in Central Park. Thank you.
Yeah, it's like the options, they couldn't be clearer. You know, the stakes couldn't be clearer. Yeah, it's such a good point to bring up the ketchup because let's just never forget the ketchup on the walls in Trump's first administration and how, you know, this man has the temper of a 2-year-old and we cannot trust this man or any man with the nuclear codes. I think it's a woman's job through and through. Sorry, I said it.
It's just called being rational and logical. And I see that really pointing in one direction. So we said what we said and we stand 10 toes down. Hold on, let me 2 feet down on the floor. Okay. 10 toes.
Firm down.
So, nonetheless, we're going to get into it because they know what they're talking about. And not that we don't, but this is their topic, okay? Like, experts, I mean, hello, they work for the Federation of American Scientists. Like, obviously, they know their shit. You know what I'm saying? They know their shit.
Right.
So, without further ado, here's Mackenzie and Ileana. All right. Welcome, guys. Welcome to what's going to be such a fun conversation about literally nuclear weapons. Okay. Fun. Nuclear weapons. We're putting these two things together, which is crazy. We're so excited to have you guys. And before, you know, we get really into the background of everything, what is FAS? Can you guys give us the background, the scoop? What's the deal?
Yeah, well, thanks so much for having us. We're really excited to come on here and chat with you all about some nukes. But I'll just jump in really quick and just kind of give the lowdown. So FAS, Federation of American Scientists, we are a nonprofit organization based in Washington, D.C. And we were originally called the Federation of Atomic Scientists back when we were founded. And we were founded by some scientists from the Manhattan Project back in 1945. And for those who don't know, the Manhattan Project was that secret government program to develop the first atomic bomb. And that's what was discussed in the Oppenheimer movie. So it's kind of a fun fact, but one of our founders, David Hill, was actually in Oppenheimer. So there's that one scene with Rami Malek where he's in the Senate confirmation hearing for Strauss. And his character is David Hill, who is like representing the scientists So that's kind of like a fun fact that we were, that's our origin story is the Manhattan Project. And we really came out of where a bunch of those scientists who participated in the project formed FAS in response to what they saw these weapons being used for. So they saw there was an urgent need to combat arms racing and to promote public engagement on these issues. And they worked a lot on establishing international control of atomic energy. And today we're really built on that legacy. So we've expanded beyond just nuclear issues. We focus on a lot of science-based policy, but our team, where we focus on the nuclear weapons stuff still, we do continue a lot of this work on promoting public engagement, promoting transparency, and promoting accountability in government. So we do open source investigation to try and put as much data out there about, you know, the size of nuclear stockpiles, what states have what states are modernizing and how it's looking and what their policies are. And so we do a lot of work just for that democratization of information, promoting accountability with the public and governments, and then providing information for governments to talk between the two of like between governments as well. So they can use our information to kind of have dialogue about these issues without having to reveal, you know, top secret stuff or anything like that. So really our work is really cool. And we have a really strong legacy of promoting this kind of work. So it's some really exciting stuff that we get to do.
Super fascinating. I'm excited to dive in. And I assume you guys were like, on the Oppenheimer side of the Barbie Oppenheimer feud or just battle last year. I don't know, but
no comment. I don't know. As a woman in the nuclear field, I enjoyed getting to do both.
Yes, love that. Very perfect true. Answer. Well, yeah, I want to get into that too, of like how you guys got into this work and just some of your background that led you here. I think it's super, super fascinating. And for all of our science girlies out there and women in STEM, shout out. But yeah, how did you get into this line of work? It seems wild.
Yeah, so I would say that oftentimes the nuclear field is something that a lot of people who work in it joke that they stumbled into it because it's something that, you know, you come across one lecture or event that just, you know, pulls on the heartstrings and just hits you really hard. And then you decide to do it for the rest of your life. And that was very much my experience. I went to undergrad at Indiana University, where I was an international studies major, and I took a class on the history of U.S. nuclear weapons and the U.S. nuclear weapons program. And first of all, I was already just obsessed with the class because my professor was this tiny older woman who was just the smartest person ever, and she was the most compelling lecturer. She would dress to the nines every day in the cutest little pantsuits. And she would just stand in the front of the classroom and just pace back and forth, just like storytelling. And there was one day of the class where she walked in and the first thing she said was, "Would you have dropped the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki if you were Harry Truman?" And it was just dead silence. And I was sitting there like, "Absolutely not." Mm-hmm. And like a couple of people raised their hands. And she then went on to tell like the rest of the lecture that class was going through like historical documents and explaining how Harry Truman and those around him came to the decision to drop the bombs. And at the end of the class, she said, "Okay, now removing hindsight as best as you can. If you were Harry Truman in 1945 at the time, would you have dropped the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki?" And almost the entire class raised their hands. And it struck me so intensely because she followed it up by saying, like, "I wasn't doing this to justify their decision, but to show you that world leaders can use logic and rationality in order to make the decision to use nuclear weapons. And that's something that can happen again. We mm-hmm. shouldn't treat it as a historical anomaly. There will always be somebody who can find some sort of rationalization for their actions in order to use these weapons. So basically go forth and try to prevent that from happening." And pretty much since then, I decided that this was going to be my career. And the next summer or the next year, I was the TA for the class. And the next summer, I was doing my first internships in the field. So the rest was history.
Awesome.
That's really interesting. Like, especially just, yeah, it's so true. Like, and you hear, I guess, the side of a leader and the rationale behind a decision like that, for people to be like, oh yeah, I get it. But at the same time, it's like, no, like let's, anything can technically be rationalized like that. So that's really, really interesting.
Exactly. Yeah. Actually, and speaking of also just leaders and rationales and how that all like connects, obviously we have a presidential election in our midst, and the nuclear codes, nukes, and presidents always get sort of lumped naturally into, you know, one sentence and one of those things that is discussed, whether it's on a debate stage or in the news, et cetera. And so I'm really curious from y'all's perspective, like what you feel like is on the line this election season with, you know, who could possibly have that? Like, what does really, like, what is that responsibility bear of having the nuclear codes or ability to essentially, you know, put weapons of insane mass destruction into the world?
Right. Yeah, that's a great question. I think that the most important thing to know up front is that in the United States, the official policy is that the president has the sole authority to launch nuclear weapons and to make that decision. So first of all, top line, I think it's important for everybody who's going in to vote this November, they should know that whoever they're voting for and whoever becomes president is the person who has that power. Mm-hmm. And the way that that looks like on the ground is that the president every day gets a little basically index card with their nuclear codes for the day that they keep on them at all times. And that's called the nuclear biscuit. I don't know why it's called the biscuit, but it's the nuclear biscuit. And following the president at all times, or near the president at all times, is a military attaché holding this super large leather briefcase called the nuclear football that has everything in it that the president would need in order to make a nuclear launch decision. So it has targeting options, you know, it has information about all of the available systems to use, it has communications information for how to contact the launch centers, and even has a secure landline to communicate with those command centers so the president can just do it right then and there. So tangibly, it is, you know, on the ground, a very easy authority for the president to execute.
Yeah.
I didn't know that. I feel like I've heard the nuclear football and all of those things. Also, like, just as someone who hates to like change their password, I always thought the nuclear codes were just like always the same. So to know that they're changing all the time, smart, but so interesting that I didn't know all of that. And there's like a literal suitcase being brought around following the president. Wow.
You know, and I think at one point the codes was actually like 000000. So
yeah, and they were like, I would have figured that one out.
That would have been a password I came up with for sure.
Yeah, and there's actually a fun fact with the nuclear biscuit is that there was two situations in history in which it was lost or temporarily misplaced because when there was an attempted assassination against Ronald Reagan and he was rushed to the hospital and they stripped him of his clothes, the biscuit somehow found its way into a trash can in the hospital and was recovered later when they realized that it was gone. And I believe it was Lyndon B. Johnson. I could be wrong about that, but I'm pretty sure it was Lyndon B. Johnson or JFK, one of them, sent their suit off for dry cleaning and the nuclear biscuit was inside the soup still.
That would be me too. I mean, Jesus, all of these things, I'm like, me and Sam don't do admin, you know, so
no,
someone's got to carry that biscuit for us. Oh my gosh, this is crazy. So, and it's like, just to emphasize the point too around like the president has all the power when it comes to nuclear codes, nuclear decisions. Like typically when we think about really any decision, especially a large decision like that a president can or has to make, like there's Congress involved, or there's different like things that, you know, this balance of power that we're always like leaning on. It's good to know. And it's honestly like something I feel like isn't talked about in an election cycle of like, no, this is actually something that like this is such a clear decision of like, there's two options. One person has the nuclear codes and can press go at any time. And like, that's just something to consider. And it's just not talked about enough. So like, really, really fascinating stuff.
Can you also give a brief overview of like the state of nuclear weapons around the world? Like what countries have them? Like what are the current like threats or just what's going on in terms of like nuclear power?
So basically there are 9 nuclear weapon states, or there, I'm sorry, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. There's 5 nuclear weapon states. It's like the legal term for the NPT, but there are 9 countries that have nuclear weapons in the world. And so that we have the US, Russia, UK, France, China, Israel, India, Pakistan, and then the last one is North Korea. And that's in the order that they got their nuclear weapons. And according to the data that we track and have tracked for a few decades now, there are about 12,000 nuclear weapons in the world. And around 9,500 of those are earmarked for delivery. So they're not in like this reserve kind of, you know, like held in reserves or retired kind of position. But 9,500 of those could be used by any of these countries. And so it's a really high number, and it's gone down a lot since the Cold War. So that's a good point, but I think still at the same time, it's a really high number. And the US and Russia combined have by far a majority of those weapons. So the fact that a lot of those weapons are held by just 2 countries that are at odds at each other more often than not is really scary as well. And then, so all of these weapons can be delivered by 3 general categories. It's something that we call the triad. So there's land-based weapons, air, and then sea. So for example, for the United States, it has what's called international or intercontinental ballistic missiles that are launched from the ground in silos. Those could be road mobile or launched from trains, like rail mobile systems, depending on what country just has what system. And then there are air launch capabilities. So we have air launch cruise missiles and gravity bombs. And then there are submarine launched ballistic missiles that are launched from submarines. And so that's just an example of what the US has. And again, the US and Russia has, and US, Russia, India, and China are the ones that have all 3 of those different types of systems. And one of the problems we're seeing is that some countries are trying to develop, like North Korea, for instance, is trying to develop that triad capability by testing new delivery systems, testing new types of missiles. So that's something that we've definitely seen as a growing concern in recent years.
I'm so curious also too, like why these, like every country, including ours, is almost like so laser focused, so obsessed with nuclear firepower. Like what is the story with that? Because it just feels like such a, like the obsessive ex-boyfriend, like that's how it feels.
I think that there's a few different phenomena at play to explain this obsession, like you mentioned. Partially, there's this thing that in the field we call mirror imaging, which is the phenomenon of one country gets something, and so another country is like, I have to have that too. Even if it doesn't actually make sense strategically, or even if it's not a system that they like could actually use militarily, they're like, well, they have it, so I need it. And it's this idea that you can only counter a capability if you have that exact same capability. And so it just leads to this like snowball effect of one country develops something and then another does. And then they're all like, well, I need it too. So that's one of the things. But then also, you know, the geopolitical threat environment, it is changing constantly. And there's certain hotspots around the world where there's increased points of tension. And 2 countries that have nuclear weapons find themselves in a situation where they're in somewhat of like a face-off. And it might be a situation that actually has nothing to do with nuclear weapons. It could be political. It could be based on territory. It could be based on just like historical differences. And nuclear weapons are then used as a tool to coerce or deter, you know, the other country. So it's this idea that, you know, they're used as a tool in some ways with this perception that they're not even going to be used, but countries know that they can use them as a leveraging tool in situations that actually have nothing to do with nuclear weapons. So that's another major part of it.
They're like the ultimate tool of coercion, where if you're a state with nuclear weapons, you're almost it feels like you're untouchable, right? And there are so many examples throughout history that people will point to where countries with nuclear weapons are just treated differently. And it is really unfortunate. And I think that's starting to change in some cases as well. But really, it is such a big priority for countries to be able to have this weapon that they can yield. And maybe, like Mackenzie said, not even use, but they can yield it to coerce and to get what they want and to be able to do things that otherwise would be, frankly, unimaginable.
Yeah, it's like almost like a little bit of like keeping up with the Joneses vibe in one respect of it, you know, but also at the same time, it's like, yeah, here's our chip in the game, like we can play it. And I think like we continue to sort of see that happen. I'm so curious in terms of deterrence, though, and trying to bring the temperature down, like what's going on in that realm? And also like, what have we seen work and could like hopefully see, you know, continue to spur some reduction in things?
Yeah. So there's basically a lot of people in the field are worrying about a lot of things that are going on right now. And there's just so much that's happening. Some of the really big things that has been making it into the news and really been talked about a lot more frequently, really is with China significantly expanding its arsenal. This is a huge change that just hasn't been the case in since it's had its arsenal, really. And it's not just expanding the size of its arsenal, but just the infrastructure around it as well. And this is like for reasons that are still debated by experts as well. So we're just not in good communication with China. And so there's a lot of confusion and opacity that really makes the situation a little bit worse just because we're not exactly sure what's going on. And you just kind of have to like make guesses or assumptions about stuff. So that can be really dangerous. And then of course, after its illegal invasion of Ukraine, Russia has been increasing its nuclear signaling and nuclear threats. And that can just be so dangerous, and it has caused so many ramifications, not just for the specific context in Ukraine. And I mentioned North Korea building up with new systems, and they're making a lot of threats and changing their nuclear policy to something that's a lot more dangerous. And then there's been, like Mackenzie referenced, regional tensions. So you've got India and Pakistan, and they're both nuclear armed. And so at any point in time, there can be miscommunication or misunderstanding that just leads to really big problems. Yeah. And so there's just a lot of stuff that people are thinking about right now. And Mackenzie did a great explanation about the mirroring problem, where when you see one country building up, it makes you worried about your own safety. We've had really historic things happening, like Finland and Sweden joining NATO because of some of these fears that they have about Russia and the nuclear threats. So there's really been a lot of concern and change just around the world. I mean, South Korea was talking about wanting either U.S. nukes or their own nuclear weapons back on their territory, and they've been gone since 1991. So there's just a lot of concern going on over this expansion, and then the increased rhetoric around nuclear weapons and just irresponsible threatening and what we call saber rattling.
Interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I feel bad just like adding to the list of things we all need to be worrying about, but just like a couple more things. So there's, you know, one that hasn't been as hot in the news lately, but it's kind of in the back of people's minds still, is, you know, this potential risk of Iran getting nuclear weapons as they expand their domestic nuclear, you know, infrastructure capability. So that's something that's kind of still in the back of people's minds. And then another thing is there is only one arms control treaty remaining around the world, which is the New START treaty between the US and Russia. And that treaty expires early on in 2026. And it is looking very, very, very likely that there's not going to be a follow-on treaty negotiated because of the tension between the US and Russia right now. Neither of them are willing to sit down at the table to negotiate a new treaty to follow on to New START. So after early 2026, for the first time in decades, there will be zero arms control treaties in the world restraining the level of nuclear weapons countries can have. That's obviously a major concern. And we're generally seeing just kind of this collapse in emphasis on arms control and desire to go to the table with each other. And that's a huge concern. And then in general, I would say just kind of the overarching concerns are each one of these nine nuclear weapons powers are investing more money in their nuclear arsenals. They are modernizing their nuclear arsenals. Many of them are expanding their nuclear arsenals. And governments are becoming less transparent about their nuclear arsenals and the actions that they're taking, which increases the risk of misunderstandings happening, miscalculations happening, and also just makes diplomacy really difficult when you can't talk to each other about what you're doing.
Yeah.
So I would add just those little things onto the list.
Tiny, tiny little things.
Sure. But I think, too, that makes it, like, with who's going to be in the White House so much more important, because you think about, like, okay, who's going to be the Secretary of State? Who's going to be, like, running the State Department? Like, who are running all these diplomatic channels that could either get that treaty back online 2026 or see it go totally away, or there be some other new, you know, actual, you know, capability to bring, you know, people together to the table? Like, that in and of itself, too, is, like, something that I think people should really think about. Like, it's not just, like, you know, the president's who they're pulling in to do all this diplomacy with and, like, keep things copacetic, for lack of a better word.
Absolutely.
And something that I think about all the time, too, is just our relationship with allies and how, I mean, you bring up a great point about the people who are in positions of leadership in the U.S., whether it's, like, you know, like, it could be local governments and their relationships with other cities and states. It could be, you know, the president or even down into his cabinet. Like, the way that we treat and value ally relationships is so, so important for, like, this communication aspect, the aspect of diplomacy and being able to work together on some of these issues. And if that's not a priority for whoever is going to be in leadership, then that could be really, really detrimental, especially for this aspect of transparency that Mackenzie talked about. I mean, the major problem with New START ending in 2026 is there's going to be no communication and openness about the numbers and systems that Russia and the U.S. have. So there's going to be no agreement to talk about this stuff. And so we need to really be relying a lot on our allies and the relationships that we do have to kind of support an environment that is conducive for arms control and diplomacy.
Yeah. And so as we look to, like, we're going to vote soon, all of us, like, what are those things that people should look towards in terms of, like, how their decision has a power and, like, affecting all of this, which is, like, crazy. It's like, you as an individual with your single vote, like, you really can make a difference in some of these truly, like, world altering potential decisions that could be made. Can you just explain, like, what issues around nukes that, like, you guys are specifically looking at, and, like, how as a voter you can kind of be empowered to, like, make the right decision for, like, choosing leaders who will, I guess, just, like, chill out a little bit on the nukes, you know?
Absolutely. This is my favorite question, because I know that we tend to be very doom and gloom in all of our media appearances, because it's hard not to be about nuclear weapons, but I think it's really important to leave people with some agency at the end of the conversation. And so, to start, some of the things that we're focusing on are obviously the presidential sole authority issue that we talked about earlier. And then, in addition to that, you know, domestically in the U.S., we are spending a lot of time tracking the U.S. nuclear modernization programs. So the U.S. is modernizing each leg of its triad, the triad we mentioned earlier with the land, sea, and air systems. The U.S. is building new intercontinental ballistic missiles, a new bomber plane, and new submarines, new cruise missiles, new nuclear warheads, new bombs, you know, everything under the sun. The U.S. is developing new modernized systems for. And a lot of these systems are experiencing huge cost overruns and schedule setbacks that are costing billions and billions of dollars. So something that I've spent a lot of time focusing on is the Sentinel Intercontinental Ballistic Missile, which is the program that's going to replace our current intercontinental ballistic missiles. And very recently, it came out that this program, which back in 2020, they said was going to cost $96 billion. They just announced, oops, actually, it's going to cost $141 billion. And so this is something that people should pay attention to, because that is tax dollars. And people who have a lot of influence over these programs and how much money that they get and whether or not they get approved are representatives and senators. And I think that there's a lot of power that people have to ensure that their representatives know that they are aware of these issues and that they're paying attention to them and that they're paying attention to what their representatives are doing about it. And so I think that people can wield their votes, not only for president, but also for their who's representing them in Congress, to basically ensure that more oversight is happening, mm-hmm. to make sure that the U.S. government can't spend unlimited amounts of money on new nuclear weapons.
Yeah. Yeah.
Totally. Sure. Which always makes me think, too, like with congressional races, like when there's obviously in every state, like the ones that aren't in your state matter, too, because those are the people also sitting at the table making these decisions, right. and being in committee and whatnot. So much at stake. So like what a year, but like also just like what a topic. For those that want to look more into the transparency end of things, look into some of the background details, where should people go look? Like what resources should they, you know, be reading through? What are like the places to plug?
Well, I mean, we have to plug our website. We do a lot of like really in-depth analysis, especially on the transparency and open source investigation issues. So FAS.org is a great place if you want some more detail. We also have been trying to promote kind of education on these issues through social media. So definitely check us out on social media as well if you want kind of summaries of some of the work that we've been doing. Some other ways to just get involved and to learn more. There's a lot of different websites and media companies that are putting out, you know, articles and explainers. And what do you think? Maybe like Inkstick is a good one. Rethink Media is a really great one as well. There's a lot of other organizations who do similar work to us. Maybe like the Nuclear Threat Initiative has a lot of great information about just weapons of mass destruction in general. So if you're looking for something more like educational and explanatory, definitely recommend them as well. And there's also just so many different ways to get involved, whether it's advocacy or if you're interested in like career opportunities. There's a really big bloom of early career opportunities for people in this field. People have really recognized the need to draw in newer voices and younger folks into this space. So there's a lot of different like fellowship and scholarship opportunities. You think like the Scoville Fellowship is a really great one. Places like NTI, I think, still does some. That's another good one.
Arms Control Association as well. They have internships as well. That's a good one. But yeah, so I think also just, yeah, letting younger people know that this is a career path that is available to them. Like if you don't want to make it your entire career, like Eliana and I have crazily chosen to do, you can stick with the grassroots advocacy opportunities and, you know, using your votes and political involvement and things like that. But this is also a viable career path. Mm-hmm. So, you know, happy to connect and chat with folks about, you know, school opportunities and internships and fellowships and whatnot. Yeah.
Yeah. So fascinating. Thank you both for coming on. This was awesome. Really interesting stuff. So thank you.
Thank you so much for having
us. Thanks so much.
Hey guys, popping in with a reminder to sign up for the GovHub newsletter. This weekly pop of politics is designed to share action items, resources, and quick links to civic engagement tools and topics directly to your inbox. Save it, share it, and sign up for a pinch of productive politics today by going to girlonthegov.com or visiting this episode's description.